from the number one sports site in the world. Yahoo! This is Yahoo Sports Radio. YahooSportsRadio.com.
Welcome to the FC Yahoo Soccer Podcast.
The ball, Yelovich, is an own goal! It's an own goal!
With your host, Joe Manko.
Flags up in the
sky. From Yahoo Sports and Yahoo Sports Radio.
It's Friday! It's a landslide!
Joe Manko and all the insiders from the FC Yahoo Soccer Blog bring you coverage of soccer across the world.
Premier League,
MLS,
Champions League,
La Liga,
Serie A,
and Bundesliga. It's all the coverage from soccer across the world.
This is the FC Yahoo Soccer Podcast.
Oh, it's going in!
Right now.
He's going! The US ahead! Incredibly! Within seconds!
From the Yahoo Sports headquarters in Playa Vista, California, here's your host, Joe Manko.
Hello, soccer fans. This is the FC Yahoo Soccer Podcast, episode number 3. I'm Joe Manko, the editor of the FC Yahoo Soccer Blog on Yahoo Sports. Joining me in the Playa Vista podcasting room in sunny Los Angeles is Shahan Ahmed.
Happy to be here, Joe.
And joining us over Skype, well, from New York, is Leander Charlakens.
Hey, guys.
And we got Alex Baker also from over Skype from, where are you coming from, Alex?
I'm in Pasadena today, Joe.
Okay, fantastic. Yes. You can find all of these guys' brilliant soccer insights every week on the Yahoo Sports Soccer page. That's sports.yahoo.com/soccer in the FC Yahoo Soccer blog. Gentlemen, the draw for the Copa America Centenario was held in New York City on Sunday night in a glitzy event at the Hammerstein Ballroom to complete the schedule for the summer tournament that will bring the national teams of the Americas together. That's namely the U.S. men's national team, Mexico, Brazil, and Argentina. And if you missed the draw, the spectacle that it was, you missed out on the musical talents of people named Yandel and Diego Torres. That's not Diego Costa or Fernando Torres. Diego Torres. Leandro, you were there in NYC. Tell us what you saw, and did you get up and dance to Yandel and Diego Torres?
I did not get up and dance. I did see something very, very strange and bizarre, and that I still have not quite wrapped my head around, many hours later. Rainy night in New York, and a few people waiting outside, probably half a dozen, to see all the foreign soccer coaches that I'm guessing not a lot of people had actually heard of. And then into this big ballroom with a fresco and everything, like the whole nine. That was actually only about half full, although they didn't really show that on television. They had a hype man there who very strangely kept imploring people to keep the aisles free so that the flag-waving people could get through properly, who was yelling at everybody to applaud more loudly. And it was all just a bit awkward, to be honest with you. And it really felt like what it was really supposed to be, what it was supposed to look and sound and feel like, was a World Cup draw show. And it kind of reinforced for me, and Alexi Lalas, who's one of the people up on the stage conducting the actual draw, when they finally got around to that, said that it was something of a prelude to potentially the U.S. hosting another World Cup. And it really felt like U.S. soccer as a local organizing committee was kind of auditioning in a way that was none too subtle.
Yeah, let's jump into that. This is being billed as laying the groundwork or foundation for the return of the men's FIFA World Cup back to the U.S. for the first time since 1994. Are we to believe that this is something that's going to happen? Can we really see this, the success, what we're anticipating the success of the Copa America?
Yeah, I mean, I think that this tournament could actually rival the World Cup in the sense that when we see these preseason tournaments going on all over the U.S., which haven't even had the biggest stars, they're selling out 90,000 in the Rose Bowl. They're selling out and filling up football stadiums, like NFL football stadiums, with fans for games that really don't matter and don't necessarily feature the biggest stars. in this tournament, we're going to have the biggest stars, we think. And if they are coming, you would think that the fanfare is going to be even greater than it's been in these summer tournaments, which are meaningless. So, yeah, I mean, I think that the sport has grown exponentially since 1994. So coming into this tournament, we're going to see we really don't know what we're going to see, but I would imagine it's going to be completely nuts once it gets going. I think people just haven't really figured out that this is happening yet. It hasn't quite been marketed fully.
When do we think people are going to get excited for this tournament? Sunday night, this is the only indication that I've seen that there is interest in this tournament was, you know, the hashtag Copa 100 was trending on Twitter. Take it for what it is, but I just don't get the sense that the public or the soccer public is fired up for this yet.
Well, I think you've struck on a real key here, and that's for the big players to show up. I asked Jurgen Klinsmann last night if he's expecting the other countries to bring their strongest lineups, and he said he absolutely thinks they will be. So that should mean James Rodriguez and Neymar and Lionel Messi and Luis Suarez. He said he certainly intends to bring the strongest possible U.S. team along that he can. But I think we've seen historically with these major tournaments in the U.S., that it takes a little while for people to realize that they're happening. I mean, that's even true to an extent with the Men's World Cup when they're not being held here, that, you know, it takes a few games for people to go, oh, hey, this thing is going on. We should probably pay a little bit of attention to it. So maybe we shouldn't be terribly surprised that, you know, people just don't really understand what this is yet, which would also explain why maybe yesterday's draw wasn't all that big of a deal yet.
Sure, and if I could jump in on what Leander's saying there. You know, there were incidents back in 94 when the World Cup was here last time where there's fans, they're dressed up in all their World Cup regalia going to games, and cars are slowing down and asking them, you know, where are y'all headed? Because people at that time just didn't know really what the World Cup was or that it was going on here in our backyard. So I think, as Leander said, it takes a while for the process to kind of snowball, but I agree with Shahan, that I think this could be very big. If you remember back to when Barcelona played against the Galaxy at the Rose Bowl, I think it was 6 years ago, there's 90,000 people in attendance. It was the biggest game since the 94 World Cup final in the U.S. So I think there's the market. If the Neymars and the Hamases do come, then I think it will be a success.
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest problem is the name. Like, Centenario just doesn't sound really sexy at all. And, you know, the Copa 100 actually, that hashtag that was trending, that fit a lot better with the market. If they just called it the Copa 100, I think people would be able to grasp the concept a little better. World Cup, we've heard about. Obviously, everyone knows that. I think some of it is just it doesn't quite roll off the tongue properly, and people aren't quite accustomed to hearing about it because, frankly, it's never happened before.
So we're under the assumption that Lionel Messi is coming. He's going to play for Argentina. Neymar is coming to play for Brazil. Luis Suarez is coming to represent Uruguay. And James Rodriguez is going to be here playing for Colombia. Now, out of those, these guys are being promoted. From what I've seen so far, they're the ones that are being, you know, held up as the main attractions other than the U.S. men's national team. Are they guarantees? I mean, are they really coming? Do you have thoughts on Neymar? No?
Yeah, well, Dunga said he hasn't spoken to Barcelona yet about releasing the player because, you know, Neymar, I think for the Copa America, the clubs are obligated to pass on the players, but for the Olympics, they're not. And the Olympics are going on in Rio. Brazil crashed out of the 2012 World Cup in the Olympics in the finals. Brazil's never won a gold medal in the Olympics. It's something that is definitely a high priority for guys like Neymar. They've talked about winning something for Brazil that Brazil hasn't won before for this sport, which is unique. So if he opts to go with the Rio 2016 Olympics instead of the Centenario Copa America, I mean, it would be understandable. It could even definitely happen. I don't think Jurgen Klinsmann would have privileged knowledge whether or not Neymar is going to do that at this point. And, you know, nothing official has been decided. He's on all the posters. He's definitely one of the, I'd say, top two headliners alongside Messi. So if he didn't come, I think it'd be a massive blow to the tournament. Remains to be seen, but you know, asking a player in over the summer to play in both those tournaments would be, I think, a little bit too much. So I think there is going to be some picking and choosing. And if he went, you know, with Rio 2016, I don't think any of the Brazilians, especially considering it's in their home country, would fault him for doing that.
I think Shahan's absolutely right about that, because there is always a lot of bartering going on between club and country. I mean, it's that eternal strife between, you know, the people that actually pay the salary, and especially at Barcelona, where it's an enormous salary and where the season is so, so long. I mean, they're going to be probably in four competitions all the way to the end, you know, and there was the Club World Cup, not to forget. He's going to be pretty tired by the summer, so it really even wouldn't be fair to ask him to play in those two tournaments. And he's going to be under enormous pressure to be at the Olympics, because, you know, the home country is always expected to perform and to really, you know, deliver in the medal count. And soccer is going to be one of the sports, I think, where Brazil is really hoping to put some points on the board, especially because I think they're going to struggle in a lot of other sports. And that is, for the Brazilians, the key sporting event this summer. So I wouldn't be surprised if he goes to the Olympics and he doesn't show up to this tournament, because I just don't see him doing both. And I certainly don't see Barcelona being very happy about him going to both tournaments. And it would be pretty hard to blame the club.
If I could also jump in here, you know, this is going to be going on at the same time as the European Championships. There's going to be some overlap between the Euros. So it's going to be a congested summer for tournaments. And I realize we're talking about a different pool of players with the Euros. But as far as the tournament's overall impact, you wonder if the Euros might – how many soccer tournaments is the American public ready for in one summer is, I guess, the question I'm asking.
I don't, that's a very good point. So we have ESPN has the rights – for the Euros, and Fox has the rights for the Copa America Centenario. We just started seeing ads, I think, on ESPN for the Euros, but we're about to get bombarded, right? So this is going to be a competition for, you know, basically the soccer TV viewer in this country. And it's a very good point, Alex, because how much we talk about how much our knowledge, our appetite for soccer has grown. This is going to be, if you love soccer, get ready to overdose.
Sure. And where's this going to leave MLS this summer? You know? who's going to have time to watch that?
Yeah, I mean, no, go ahead, Leander.
It seems to me that, you know, the Euro, the last time around, Euro 2012, really moved the needle in the U.S. In a way that it hadn't in 2008 or before. So that's a tournament that a lot of people are now considering sort of a substitute World Cup. And it's going to just plainly have more players that the American, you know, NBC-watching, Premier League-loving soccer crowd is going to have heard of. And that really matters. I mean, when the players on the field are names that they're already familiar with, rather than it's, you know, Venezuela against someone like Haiti or maybe some matchup that I didn't just make up, that's going to be important. So they do have, I think, a lot of bridges to overcome, and it's the Euro is an established tournament. It's something they've heard of, and the Centenario is something that needs to be explained. It's something that's a one-off. So if you look at the grand scheme of things, I think if this tournament, you know, does as well stateside as a Women's World Cup would have, especially when it was hosted here in 1999 or 2003, I think that would already be a pretty solid performance.
I think the biggest factor in this is going to be the U.S. men's national team. I mean, the interest in the U.S. when the national team is playing spikes. It doesn't really matter. Even in the World Cup when they were playing down in Brazil, it spiked when the U.S. is playing. Everyone gets nuts into it. So if the U.S. can get past that group of death and, you know, let's say they match up against Brazil in the quarterfinals, then all of a sudden I think it's going to be just madness. I think it's going to be insane. People are going to get more – they're not going to care about the fact that Italy's playing in France for the Euros. You know, they're going to care about the fact that the U.S. is playing against Brazil. And that's the whole point of this tournament. It's a unique opportunity to pit the U.S. in competitive play against some of the biggest countries. Frankly, I mean, this doesn't happen. It is a one-off, but it's a really special one-off. And the fact that the games are happening in the U.S. as well makes it a different level of accessibility. And, I mean, frankly, I think that as long as the U.S. doesn't completely, you know, fail and crash out, which is a possibility, let's be honest, that's a tough groove they got, I think that the interest is going to be spiked, and I don't think people are going to get distracted. I mean, you know, we were talking about Fox and what was the other one? Fox and ESPN have the rights. NBC has the rights to the Olympics, and they're going to be showing, I mean, the international sports watching audience, which encompasses the soccer fans as well, they're going to have plenty of distractions, but I think at the end of the day, we're also going to get that mainstream American sports fan, which we tend to get when the World Cup is on and the U.S. is playing, or if it's a USA-Mexico, you know, Gold Cup final. We start getting those fans that don't normally necessarily even pay attention to the sport.
I think it's quite possible that we'll see a situation where people will come to the Centenario games in person and the stadiums will be packed, but the TV watching audience will actually prefer to watch the Euro or the women at the Olympics, and where you have a really strange mix of viewerships. I mean, it's important to note, as Joe alluded to, that they don't overlap. But it just kind of becomes a question at a certain point of how much soccer people are going to be willing to consume during their summer.
I'm going to spell this out for those who don't know yet. This is going to be your summer soccer schedule. You're going to have the Copa America Centenario beginning on June 3rd, and then you're going to have the Euros starting, and then you're going to have the International Champions Cup with teams like, you know, we've already heard that Bayern Munich is coming here, and we have Arsenal playing the MLS All-Stars. And then you have the U.S. women's national team, you know, defending their title at the Rio Games. And what we expect or hope to see the men's under-23s playing in Brazil as well. I think this is a perfect time to take a quick timeout. After the break, we'll talk about this, as Leander put it in his story last night, the deathly group of the United States men's national team, and what this tournament could mean for one Jurgen Klinsmann and his tenure as U.S. men's national team coach. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the FC Yahoo Soccer Podcast, direct from the FC Yahoo Soccer blog at yahoosports.com. And if you're looking for a sports radio morning show that is just a little bit more entertaining and has a little bit of fun, along with all your coverage of sports every morning, check out the Steve Zabin Show, direct from Yahoo Sports Radio.
Well, we go from fat Scott to skinny. Did you see Barry Bonds as hitting coach for the Miami Marlins?
I did not see him standing up. I did see him at a podium addressing the press.
Then here, take a gape at this picture right here. You're looking great, Barry. I mean, it looks like you're not on steroids anymore.
My. He looks like a slender old man.
Look at that guy.
That's impressive.
The incredible rise and fall, the inflation and deflation of one Barry Bonds. Look at his head.
You look like a normal size human,
Mr. Bonds. You look normal again.
You know what? Maybe now you can fit into the Hall of Fame one day.
Steve Zabin, mornings, 6 a.m. until 10 a.m. Eastern on Yahoo Sports Radio. Listen live and check out the podcast of The Steve Zabin Show, yahoosportsradio.com. It's time to get back to everything football and soccer from across the world. This is the FC Yahoo Soccer Podcast. This is the FC Yahoo Soccer Podcast from Yahoo Sports Radio and Yahoo Sports. Once again, your host, Joe Lago.
Welcome back to the FC Yahoo Soccer Podcast, episode number 3. You can find our insight on the beautiful game every week on the Yahoo Sports Soccer page, sports.yahoo.com/soccer in the FC Yahoo Soccer blog. I'm Joe Lago. Joining me today is Shahan Ahmed. We got Alex Baker and Leander Charlakins via Skype. Guys, let's get into that deathly group of the U.S. men's national team. If it wasn't the group of death, it was certainly close to it. Jurgen Klinsmann's American side drew the top ranked teams in two of the pots, Costa Rica and Paraguay, and then they got Colombia, which was better than drawing defending Copa America champion Chile or Uruguay and Luis Suarez. But at this moment, so Jurgen Klinsmann has set the goal for the Copa America Centenario for the U.S. to get out of this group. At this moment, is the U.S. good enough to get out of this group? If not, where are the problem spots?
I'm gonna say this group this team is probably not good enough to get out of this group. And yet somehow I do think that they will find a way to, because that's sort of what we do. We get out of the group and then we fall by the wayside. But I think there's problem spots up and down the pitch. You've got, you know, a generation that's sort of gone by. The Landon Donovans and the Clint Dempseys are fading. And yet there's really no one that I think is convincing as far as bringing that X factor to the attack. You know, where's Julian Green, who was supposed to be our great hope 2 years ago? He's not even on the team at the moment. You know, you've got guys who are pretty interesting. Jossie Zardes, but he's an MLS striker. I just don't know if he's got what it takes to compete at this level and to score the goals. You know, who's going to score the goals for the USA this summer?
So the hope coming off the end of last season was Darlington Nagbe, the wonderful midfielder for the MLS champion Portland Timbers. From all indications, and Lander, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but all indications from the January camp was that Nagbe did not, I wouldn't say assert himself, but make enough impact and imprint to force him into a regular, what everyone is hoping him to be, which is the closest thing we have to a number 10, to someone in the midfield to facilitate the offense.
Nagbe is kind of like Jossie Zardes in a sense, where he's a guy who's young and who's talented and who's sort of made a mark on MLS and is beginning to assert himself, but you kind of wonder if at the international level they're quite up to snuff. I mean, these guys are not, you know, they're not 17, 18 and these amazing prospects. Zardes is 24 and Nagbe is 25. And I just don't really see it with them necessarily. So you might have a situation again where Michael Bradley is the best player in three different midfield positions, you know, the 6, the 8, and the 10, and he winds up playing in whatever spot Klinsmann happens to be the thinnest and needs him the most. So I don't think that I see him starting in central midfield against Colombia. And to answer your opening question, I actually don't think the U.S. gets out of the group this time around. They did get a really, really difficult draw. It's a group of death. At the same time, you know, all three of those teams, Colombia, Costa Rica, and Paraguay, didn't have the most amazing years in 2015. They all kind of, you know, Colombia and Costa Rica in particular really fell off, I think, from their World Cup form. Paraguay won three of their 14 games in 2015, even though they did get to the Copa America semis. Costa Rica hasn't won a game on U.S. soil since 1995. And Colombia is kind of in a situation where James is obviously James, to state the very obvious, but you've got guys like Jackson Martinez and Freddy Guarin who have moved to China. You know, Falcao is past it. These are not amazing teams. But then you look at the U.S., and it's just, it's not a team necessarily that has holes all over the field. I mean, they've got sort of cover for pretty much every position, even though they are fairly thin up front. But they're a team, I think, that doesn't really convince you in any line. If they don't have glaring, enormous weaknesses, they don't really have strengths anywhere either. There isn't any spot on the field where I look at the U.S. and think, this is where they go at teams. This is where they punish them. This is where they're going to win their games. It's just such a kind of flat and mediocre team at the moment. And, you know, maybe we jump on Klinsmann a little bit here, but it's not particularly savvy or it's not using these tactics that are bamboozling opponents. So I just kind of don't see it this summer.
Yeah, I don't think the U.S. is going to make it out of the group either. You know, we're talking about what the problem spots are. I think the goalkeeper spot is the biggest problem. Last year, in the World Cup, Tim Howard was incredible. I mean, he was an octopus in goal, right? And right now, the U.S. doesn't, they need somebody that can shut it down and kind of plug those leaks that are going to happen in the back. Just always happens, seemingly, with the Klinsmann U.S. men's national team. And, you know, I don't think that they have the strength in front of goal right now, and I think that's going to be what ultimately does them over.
Well, look, if there's any optimism to be had for the U.S. men's national team off the January camp and the two friendlies, is that Jozy Altidore, who everyone, you know, say what you want about him, he came in early to the camp. He was fitter. He was hungry. and he scored in both games. And make it for what you will. I mean, they were friendlies. They were come from behind, or there were last second victories against Iceland and Canada. The Canada game was less inspiring, not that inspiring if you are a U.S. men's national team supporter. Look, help me out, guys. I'm trying to come up with some positives.
Well,
I brought up Jozy Altidore, which is going to get me ridiculed. So, what are the reasons?
I'll throw a name at you, Joe. I'll throw Fabian Johnson at you. There's a cause for optimism for the USA. One of the best players in the Bundesliga this season. He's a guy who could compete at the highest level.
Well, I think he has Michael Bradley disease as well, because he's the best player in three positions also, at left wing, left back, and right back. And that does prevent him, I think, a little bit from really getting into a rhythm with the U.S. And I think that's why he hasn't been as consistently good with the U.S. as he has been in the Bundesliga. To go back to Jozy Altidore, you know, for all the hopes that have been harbored for him for so long, I likened him once in a column a while ago to an exotic plant. And what that basically is to say is that the conditions have to be absolutely perfect for him to thrive, and otherwise he withers. The system has to be right. You know, he has to be played in the right way. He needs somebody beside him. He needs the exact right kind of service. He needs the opponents to play a certain way. He needs the referees to make certain calls. I just find it to this point where now we can reasonably say that, especially with the early start that he got as a professional, he's 26 now. He's in his prime. But he's still in a situation where I find him completely unpredictable and mercurial. And he's just not a guy that you can count on to score goals. Because if you actually look back on his sort of scoring record for the U.S., he has gone entire years without scoring, and then he'll have six games where he scores eight. And it's with him, it's feast or famine. And that's not to poke fun at his having lost weight in going into camp, but he's a guy that you just don't know what you're going to get. And that's a really scary thing going into the going into a major tournament like Copa America. But on the other side of that, the U.S. is still extremely dependent on him. Most of his goals are equalizers or game winners. And you saw very well at the World Cup what happens when he pulls up limp in the first game, and they run out of trouble. They run into trouble really quickly.
You guys are bringing me down this rabbit hole. I can't. should we be asking questions about Michael Bradley then? Altidore's Toronto FC teammate. It really began in Brazil at the World Cup, where he didn't seem to be himself. He was not comfortable in the spot that Klinsmann was playing him, which was a little forward upfield to be the engine of the attack. And, you know, we've seen flashes of what we think and hope Michael Bradley can be, but it's really been if you want to look at it overall, it's really been an uneven performance by Michael Bradley. And, well, here's also a question. What is the alternative?
Well, with Michael, it's a little bit of an awkward conversation, because it boils back down to, you know, is it better to play 50% of the time in Italy or to play 100% of the time in MLS? And, you know, on those grounds, you could reasonably argue that the U.S. national team was better off with him playing at Roma and playing against these monstrous midfielders in practice every single day, now that he's come to MLS and maybe regressed a little bit. In Michael's defense, he's been shuffled around the U.S. Midfield quite a lot. He does play the 10, and then he's an 8, and he just kind of goes back and forth. So that's not entirely helpful. He has said to me in the past that he likes playing in that sort of advanced role, although probably anyone who's been a defensive midfielder at any level would rather be an attacking midfielder. But then the final thing with him, and I think this is important to note just for the sake of balance, he has had some injuries in the last year that have slowed him down a little bit. They've not really been major injuries where he's had to sit out for super long stretches of time, but he has been hobbled a little bit, and he is the sort of player who, you know, doesn't really take off and you know, beg off to the to the club doctor unless he really, really has to. So, you know, maybe he deserves a little bit of credit for playing through some necks.
Yeah, for me, it's for Michael Bradley, I just don't think he's a number 10. I found it odd that they stuck him a little bit further forward. Going back to what Leander said, I mean, I've played in plenty of Sunday leagues. Every single person wants to play the number 10. It's the best position. You don't have to run very much. You just get to be creative. You get to, you know, do a little simple dink, and you look like you just handed the greatest assist of all time. I just don't think he has the level of creativity that you want from the number 10, going back to what we said earlier in terms of no one's really emerged into that role. I think that his strength is a little bit deeper in that midfield. He's definitely a center midfielder. I don't think you put him on the outside. I wouldn't personally. You know, kind of also going back a little bit to the Fabian Johnson thing, do you guys, and I'll throw it out to Alex and Leander, do you guys think that Fabian Johnson should be a winger, or do you think he should be further as, you know, as a fullback? Alex, go first.
I think he should be a winger. I think he scores goals at the highest level, and there aren't a lot of guys in the USA structure who do that right now. You know, you've got some reasonably good alternatives as fullback, but I think that players like that who can bring that X factor, who can score you goals, which is the most difficult thing to do, I think for the USA, we need to put those players in the position where they can do that.
I agree. He's sort of inconsistent playing as a winger. To me, he disappears for large portions of the game, and you kind of don't even see him. That's also a function of having to track back so much when you play as a winger for the U.S. national team. I mean, there is a lot of defensive work that you have to do because in so many games they are pinned back. I do think, though, that he has some abilities that very few players in the player pool have, namely, you know, being able to take someone on and get by them and to serve in a good cross. So I think that the upside of playing him further up the field overshadows the downside of not having him in defense, because there are defenders that don't give you nearly as much going forward, but that can do sort of a solid job just holding it down. Let's take even Tim Ream at left back or someone like that. Someone who can just kind of hold down the fort. So I think that given the dearth of decent wingers, you are best off playing him a little bit forward.
I think it would be best if Fabian Johnson started at left back because of his experience. And like, he is a versatile player. And then if they need to go get goals, you know, throw Fabian forward as a winger. I think it's more of a situational thing, because I don't see convincing options really at either fullback spot. And, you know, we can talk about, you know, going back to the Jonathan Bornstein days, but this is...
let's not.
Well, let's talk about Jermaine Jones. Like, where's Jermaine Jones going to play? We know he's going to be included in the squad. Am I crazy to say that? I don't think Klinsmann's going to force him out anytime soon, unless he's injured somehow.
I don't think so either, and I think he certainly has his utility in games. He reminds me a little bit of Marouane Fellaini early on in his Belgium career, where they wanted to play him as a holding midfielder, and it just didn't work because he just didn't have the tactical discipline to hang back and to stay in front of the defense and kind of be that padlock, that anchor that they really needed, which drove his coaches mad, of course. But Jones kind of has that same problem, where especially at this stage in his career, he still has a lot of value if you kind of park him in front of your defense and he kind of becomes a rich man's Kyle Beckerman. But you really need to impress upon him that is his job, and that he needs to hang out there and kind of stay there and not foray past the halfway line pretty much, and to stop tackling people all the time. But even if that is the job, because he's going to get sent off. It's pretty amazing that he never has for the U.S., but one of these days he'll get sent off. But he does have still have some use in that regard.
It's David Luiz syndrome, I think you're describing over there.
Yeah, exactly. Just one line further up the field.
Guys, let's get into what the impact could have on Jurgen Klinsmann's tenure as U.S. men's national team coach. Leander, why don't you get into just what the tournament will mean in the scope for Klinsmann's tenure?
Well, there are different kind of angles to this. On the one hand, Sunil Gulati, the U.S. soccer president, hasn't given any indication that anything short of qualifying for the World Cup would cost Jurgen his job. And that's partly because he has enormous political capital staked to his success. Gulati had pursued him for years and years and years before he finally got him, gave him a fat contract, three or four times what his predecessor, Bob Bradley, who didn't do a bad job at all, was getting. Now he's gotten a raise. It seems like he's gone from $2.5 million to about $3 million a year. Truly an enormous contract by U.S. soccer's financial standards. So that's one part of it. That would be very expensive to buy him out because he's got a contract through 2018. On the other hand, even though he does have the U.S. on target to qualify for the World Cup, 2015 was horrid. They had a good little run going into the Gold Cup semifinals, but then they lost to Jamaica, which was just an abomination on home soil. They should have at least gotten to the final of that tournament. They haven't looked good since. And if they have a three and out performance at the Copa America, if they don't get out of the group stage, that's two major tournaments in a row where the U.S. has really badly failed, I dare say. And that's not to mention having lost the playoff for a spot at the Confederations Cup, which they're not going to get to. And then, not to forget, the U.S. might not make it to the Olympics if they lose that two-game playoff with Colombia. And that's also that falls under Klinsmann's purview as technical director. So I don't know necessarily that his job is on the line, but if the optics aren't bad already, they're going to get super bad if the U.S. gets creamed at the Copa America.
Yeah, I personally think that if he doesn't make it out of the group stage, the U.S. should make a change. And I don't think the financial implications really should matter because I thought he got a pass in that playoff game. I thought that the Gold Cup was definitely an abomination. There have been too many stumbles and not enough bright lights coming out of the U.S. national team. Okay, the World Cup, they did well. They slightly overexceeded expectations. But a lot of that, like I said, came down to Tim Howard just standing on his head and playing incredible. They did play some good attacking football. Portugal was abysmal in that World Cup, and that really helped out the U.S. a good amount. I think that when you really look at on the balance of everything he's done, he may have helped change some of the culture, but at this point, if he's not successful in these tournaments, you have to make a change. I mean, where do you draw the line? Is there a line for Jurgen Klinsmann, Alex?
I don't know that there really is. I think he's kind of in this sort of Arsene Wenger protected species category right now. And I agree with you that if he doesn't make it out of this group, then there's every reason to want him to be fired because, we've talked about how bad 2015 was for the USA. But we're also talking about how this is a tournament that is trying to define its relevance. And I think success or failure in the Copa America, it's not going to matter that much overall. It's about the World Cup. And as long as Klinsmann keeps us on track to qualify that for that, I think his job is safe.
Shahan, you mentioned Jurgen changing the culture, and that's something that he has certainly talked about. But like the many things that he talks about, there is quite some distance between what he says and what actually happens. Because, he wanted to double down on fitness. Well, the U.S. national team was always fit. He wanted to sort of get serious about technology. Well, Bob Bradley certainly always had state-of-the-art equipment and people who knew how to use it around his team. And I just don't know that Jurgen has really delivered all that much in terms of these sort of off-field intangibles that you're really paying somebody that market premium for that he is getting.
No, yeah. When I said change the culture, I was referring to the fact that he is bringing in German players. That's
all right. Fair enough.
They speak a different language. I think we can say he's incorporating more culture into the U.S. national team.
Would you expect Klinsmann to get a pass though, because this is a group of death where expectations are low, and if they somehow miraculously get out of it, then he's accomplished something. Or if they fail, it's because he was going up against three really strong teams.
I don't think he should get a pass because I think his own rhetoric is such that he's talking about elevating the USA and becoming this team that we're going to play the big teams and we're going to match them and play against them. And, he's kind of created this world where if that's the kind of team we want to be, then we have to stop just praying that we're going to get some easy draw every time and get a pass through. And I don't think that could be an excuse for Klinsmann at this point. He's been in charge for, 5 years now. I think this is, we need to see some development, because right now you just really don't know what you'll see with the USA.
Yeah, I thought he got a pass in the run up to the Confederations Cup. I thought that was his pass. How many passes do you want to give the guy? I mean, the Gold Cup was a pass too. I mean, you got to figure he's running out of passes at some point. But like Leander said, Sunil Gulati really did go after him, really wanted him, got him. He's his guy, and Gulati makes all the decisions. So at the end of the day, it's whether or not he's happy with it. I can't imagine he's been happy with the last two tournaments, we'll call them, even though one was just a playoff game. I mean, that was in Pasadena, in California. I understand that Mexico has a lot of fans around here and they pack the house, but that's still on U.S. soil. And the U.S., it was a hell of a game, but man, that you had to win that game and make it through, and they didn't. That should have been his last pass, for me, anyway.
I think Sunil, in that regard, is someone who I think has succeeded as U.S. soccer president over the long term, because he's very measured and he has a steady hand. He's an economics lecturer, for God's sake. He sort of preaches responsibility. And the way they looked at it was, the U.S., whether right or wrong, the U.S. got knocked out of the Confederations Cup by a wonder strike in extra time in the 118th minute or whatever that was. And, that's just kind of the bounces. And then it really depends on what country you happen to work in, whether there is an understanding for that sort of thing. And I think what keeps helping Klinsmann is that he's in a country where there's no culture at all of firing the national team coach. I can't remember, and I don't know that there's ever been a U.S. national team coach who was fired or let go or not renewed or whatever, unless it was right after a World Cup. You kind of get a cycle, you get the whole cycle, and you're not judged until the World Cup. And at the same time, I'm not entirely sure, and I'm going to point the finger at ourselves here, that the American soccer media is mature enough as an institution or has enough clout quite yet to kind of create that groundswell of discontent that's really necessary for a country to go to the length of firing its coach. Because it's certainly not going to come from U.S. soccer itself. I suppose Bob Bradley was fired in the middle of a cycle, but not so terribly long after a World Cup. And he, maybe was fired in part because Klinsmann was suddenly available. So there is some precedent there, but that's just not the way things are done by and large in U.S. soccer.
Well, Klinsmann will have two World Cup qualifiers in March, March 25th, March 29th, against Guatemala in a home-and-home series. Look, my thing with Klinsmann is he should have started building a team long ago, shuffling in. He went through how many 50, 60 players, and was mixing, matching, assessing talent. That needed to end well before going into last year's Gold Cup and the CONCACAF Cup. We have no idea who was going to play when it comes to a crucial game, a knockout round game that he says that the men's side still needs to learn how to win. We still don't know who his best 11 is, and that is on Jurgen Klinsmann. He's been in the job for 4.5 years, and it's really amazing that, other than Jose Altidore starting up top and Michael Bradley being somewhere in midfield, and we can't even say Tim Howard being a keeper anymore, but that's not really because of his drop in play. We really can't say who is going to be Jurgen Klinsmann's best 11, and that's really incredible. Before we go, look, we've been asked to create a weekly segment. This is our first attempt at something where hopefully people will come to and listen to, other than our great insight on the big headlines and topics of the moment in the soccer world. I'm going to call this the round table, where any of us can throw out what could be something that's getting something off your chest. You can use 30 seconds for a rant, or just throw something out to the group. Like, I will say Eden Hazard. to you guys, and you, every one of you can give me one sentence or a, whatever you want to say. Eden Hazard scored for Chelsea against a very weakened Manchester City side in the fifth round of the FA Cup. Chelsea fans were elated that I think someone had phrased it as the return of Eden Hazard. He assisted on two of the goals. It was a 5-1 win. I was not going overboard on a return of Eden Hazard. What do you guys think?
I mean, he played against a youth team, right? That's pretty much what we've all figured out at this point. But yeah, he did look good. I mean, he was involved in, I think, three of the goals, including the one he scored off the free kick. So hasn't scored from open play, but yeah, he did look a lot better. I think Chelsea just looks a lot better because they're not in a relegation scrap anymore, so there's that going for it. Kind of related to that, I mean, you know, everyone talks about, you know, Goose just being the caretaker manager and then moving on. Joe, why would you not want Goose to hang around? He seems to be, you know, getting these players' ears.
I wanted him to stick around the first time he was the interim manager. I think it's because can he be the guy who long-term can manage the attitudes, I was going to call them spoiled children, but can he handle the collection of talent that that basically sent Jose Mourinho out? And I think they need a bigger personality. My pick would be Diego Simeone, who, from what I can see, never talked to the guy. I don't speak Spanish. Yeah. But the guy has this I don't put up with anything persona that you see.
It's the black suit. That's what
it's a black suit. He has the he commands respect. His players play hard. And right now, I don't think I think that's what Chelsea needs. I think they need to come in and someone to make the players accountable. And Jose lost that ability because he couldn't help himself when he was trashing players in the media. And that was the end for him. That's the roundtable topic number one. I'll open up to you guys. What do you guys want to talk about?
I'll go second, I suppose. Louis van Gaal, let's talk. I think right now United's playing. At last check, I think they were up 2-0. But, you know, we're recording during that game. 3-0 now, Leander is showing me. I mean, do you think he should stay? Do you think that he should go? Do you think Jose is the right guy to come in there? Because that's been the heavily talked about rumor at this point. Alex, we'll start with you and go around.
Sure. I think if they can get Jose, and if there's a window of opportunity that might be closed by the end of the season, they should absolutely move for him. Because Van Gaal, the thing is, he's not shown any signs of making it better. He's been given a lot of money. He's spent a lot of money. And I love Louis Van Gaal. I think he's done great work in his career, but I don't see him as the man to right the ship. Is Mourinho, maybe you get two good years out of Mourinho, then he hits self-destruct and it goes to hell. But goes to heck, pardon me, podcast land. but in those 2 years, he could take Man United back. They will win a title. They will get back to where they need to be. Then, at which point, maybe someone like Ryan Giggs is ready to come along and be the long-term guy and give it that stability. So I think if they could get Mourinho, it's a no-brainer.
I'm not so convinced about Mourinho. I agree that Van Gaal needs to go. It's just he lost that club 6 months ago, if not longer. Well, you know, they did okay for a while, maybe not quite that long, but, you know, clearly it's not working and it's not going to work. And it's just kind of the way they put him out of his misery in his final season at Bayern, where they fired him like a few weeks before the end of the season because it was just getting so bad and so painful. I don't really see why they're not doing that yet. I don't see Mourinho as the solution because what that club needs is structure and, you know, bringing back the hierarchy and bringing back the systems and the protocols, and they need to be a club again. And it's not going to come from the top down because Ed Woodward is as an executive, is not the sort who can sort of impose that the way maybe someone like Daniel Levy is at Spurs. So I think they need to bring in a manager who can implement that sort of thing. I'm wondering if maybe they need someone younger, you know, who's kind of done this a few times, someone like Mauricio Pochettino. Maybe they can poach him somehow. Maybe Frank de Boer from Ajax, although I'd hate to see that. A manager like that, because Mourinho is a slash and burn type of manager, and you know he's very good at taking teams that are almost there and taking them over the top. And that's just not what United is. This is a rebuilding project. It's not a situation where they're two good players and the right tactics away from competing. I mean, it's just a shambles, and somebody needs to rebuild from scratch, pretty much.
Yeah, and I think Man United supporters are complaining about the style of play or lack of flair offensively. But if you want Jose Mourinho, I can attest that you will not get that type of soccer. He may eke out 1-0 wins, but it is not pretty. There was only the first half of the last Premier League season where Chelsea had their tails up and were going at teams. But as soon as he built up that lead, he shut it down. They went into defensive mode, protecting the lead that they had in the Premier League. And I think for the most part, that is what you're going to see from Jose Mourinho. You're not going to get the attacking, entertaining football that Man United fans are clamoring for. So for me, it's kind of odd that there is this, hope that Mourinho is going to come to Old Trafford.
Yeah, I'll finish up on that, because my opinion is actually, I think a lot of the money that was spent, and Ed Woodward can take a lot of that blame, I think it's spent on young players, and I think Louis van Gaal's done a good job of bringing young players to the side. The finished product, frankly, hasn't looked finished because these guys are too young. They really, Martial's had his ups and downs. Depay completely disappeared for a while. But these guys really haven't even come close to entering the prime of their footballing careers. Wayne Rooney's past his prime, I think we can all safely say. And it took him, being in a crazy goal drought for United to really fall off the map entirely. Defensively, they've been pretty solid for the duration of the season. I think a lot of the attacking, you can talk about how he didn't use Mata possibly correctly. I think he's gotten slightly a bad rap. I do think it's probably time for him to go. I think Gary Neville, who's won three in a row, big Gary Neville now, I think he's going to be rumored for that job. If he continues to have success at Valencia, it seemed like after, falling apart a little bit early on, the team actually didn't quit on him. And the players had, I think, reportedly a players-only meeting where they decided that, no, we're going to stick with this guy. And winning three in a row after, facing all that, and then I think the game before he won the three in a row was actually a draw against Barcelona in the second leg after he'd gotten completely demolished in the first leg. I think that might be a better solution, bring in some of those old tactics.
Alex Leander, do you have a topic for the roundtable before we get out of here?
I've got a quick little rant I'll drop in here. I think it's important that we pay attention as a soccer country to the CONCACAF Champions League, because I think it's one of the primary routes for MLS teams to respectability, and not just because I think the clubs themselves should put a little bit more into it if possible, because it's the road to the Club World Cup where you can get a little bit of recognition if you manage to get to the final so that you can get smashed by Barcelona. But it starts up again on Tuesday with the Sounders against Club America. The Galaxy have Santos. There's a few American teams that are still in play. Tigres have Real Salt Lake. It's a fun tournament, and I think it's important that as a soccer culture, we don't just pay attention to MLS, but we pay attention to our continents. Competition as well, because I think that'll help the growth of the sport in our country by sort of putting a little bit more emphasis on how our clubs do internationally.
Right.
All right, Alex.
Let me throw something out. FA Cup. We saw Manuel Pellegrini basically put out an academy team against Chelsea. Why doesn't anyone care about the FA Cup anymore? And is there any kind of hope that they will again? Leander, what do you think?
I saw this point made elsewhere, and I think it's unassailable. If, as a Premier League team, you make or indeed miss out on the Champions League or the Europa League, you the losses in revenue are enormous. They're tens of millions of dollars. The difference between making the third round or the quarterfinals or the semifinals of the FA Cup aren't really all that different, or aren't really all that big. I mean, it's not a tournament that's really resonating with fans as much as it used to, and that's partly because the teams themselves aren't as invested. But it's lost its prestige because it hasn't kind of kept up into the monetization of the sport, I think. And these days, tournaments and competitions are only as important as the prize money and as the revenue that they drive. So I think that it kind of killed itself.
Yeah, for the FA Cup, I think you asked who cares about it. I think Arsenal does. I think Arsene cares a lot. It allowed him to get trophies. He had a bit of a drought there. So, yeah, I mean, I think I'll finish it on that. Arsene and Arsenal care.
Well, thanks, guys. I think that's it for us. That's episode number 3 of the FC Yahoo Soccer Podcast. My thanks to Leander Charlakins, Alex Baker on Skype, Shahan Ahmed here in the podcasting room in Playa Vista. Thanks for tuning in, everybody. We will catch you next time. This is for my country. This is for my people. Kick off, kick off, kick off, kick off. Yeah, kick me a goal.